This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the latest fundraising reports for next year's election with Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger. But first, recently President Trump made waves with a series of tweets saying that after consultation with generals, he was banning transgender people from serving in the military. The status of the ban remains unclear since military leaders say that they are awaiting a formal order from the president. We're going to get one perspective on transgender people serving in the armed forces. Dirk Hamilton now lives in Kalamazoo. He served in the Air Force and then later the National Guard, which included a brief tour of duty in Iraq. That was before he transitioned and became a man. Dirk Hamilton, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, first of all, let's go back and talk about why did you want to join the Air Force in the first place?
Well, Gordon, I think that it may be a common story. I grew up in the hills of eastern Kentucky, and I had graduated high school. I was about 3 years after graduation, still living with my parents. College at that time had not been a good fit for me, and so I was really looking for a way to continue my adult life, and so I thought maybe the military would be a great way to get out, see the world, and earn some income.
And what did you do in the Air Force?
I was a supply troop.
And you later served in the National Guard while you were going to college, is that correct?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do in the National Guard?
Same thing, building off of my former active duty career as a supply technician. I also worked in supply with the Guard.
At that time, your gender identity was a woman, correct?
That's correct. Well, it wasn't my gender identity, but my biological identity was that of female.
When did you leave the Air National Guard?
2007.
And then when did you transition to male?
That process began for me in the summer of 2013.
So as we sit here and talk today and we weigh what President Trump has said about transgender people in the military, you are someone who obviously has a lot of, you know, background here, that you're a military background, someone who transitioned gender-wise. So what are your thoughts about what the president has said?
When I first saw an article last week about the tweet, I think it just brought to the surface some concerns that I had carried since I learned of the news that transgender people were suddenly able to openly serve in the military about a year ago. And some of those concerns were things such as concerns for, it's not that transgender identity in and of itself is not termed or considered anywhere as a disorder. What it does do for some people, a lot of people, is it brings a fair amount of what's called gender dysphoria. And that is a mental health concern because that is a type of depression. And so knowing that, you know, the military is a place where people need to be as fit as possible for duty, both physically fit and, you know, mentally fit, I had concerns for some of those vulnerabilities that transgender people often face. With mental health, with dysphoria.
Would the concern then be that somebody may, as they're going through this perhaps a discovery of their gender identity, may be experiencing things that make it difficult to serve in the armed forces?
That was my concern. That was my my questioning. Also knowing, even though I didn't transition while in the military, I know firsthand what some of my challenges were and adjustments to my own mental health, things that I went through that affected my family. And of course, because I love and care for my family, that created additional stress, if you will, or some anxieties and, you know, just some emotional things that have to be dealt with as a person transitions. I know quite a few transgender people also besides myself. And it's, you know, it's just not always an easy thing. And so knowing that persons that are actively serving in the military, if they were to be also transitioning while carrying out their military functions, if they also were contending with these added stresses and strains that you do when you transition, that I could see where, or I had a concern because I could see where that could have bearing on their ability to, you know, perform their duty.
Now you say you had a concern.
Had a concern.
Okay. That's past tense. So has something happened that's made that concern maybe not as great or even go away?
Well, I still have it to some degree because I want to say that this is still a lot of new territory. It's only been a year since transgender people were sort of given the green light to be open about their gender identity and serve in the military without repercussions or discharge. And so it takes time before you can really know how things are going to go. But my concerns have greatly lessened because I went in and started researching how did we get to that point to say we're going to allow transgender people to openly serve in the military, because I hadn't thought about that. And a lot of that stuff doesn't get reported. We don't hear about that, you know, in headline news. And so I found a report that was done back in 2015 when the Department of Defense said, wow, we've got a lot of transgender people, even though it's technically not okay for them to serve, they've been serving.
They've already
they
there.
Keep serving. They're there. They're here. So let's look at what it's going to mean to potentially permit this to become a part of our sanctioned and allowable service members to serve. And so there was the RAND Corporation did a very thorough, in-depth assessment report to provide to the Department of Defense to say, you know, this is our best estimate. And they looked at so many of the things that I had as concerns. And what it brought to me was this reassurance that they're taking all of that into consideration, the gender dysphoria, the added sometimes emotional strain that can go along with transitioning. What they are finding and prospecting is that permitting transgender people to be open and honest about who they are, and then also supporting them in whatever decisions they make as far as transitioning decisions, alleviates so much of the dysphoria or the other emotional strains. And so the benefit far outweighs the concerns.
Did you know anyone who was transgender when you were serving? I mean, there was serving at the same time you were?
Probably, but I wouldn't know it, just as they were serving with me, and they wouldn't have known it.
And they would have not wanted to tell anybody.
Correct.
At that time. So are you surprised to read that there are a fair number of military leaders, some currently who are serving and some who are retired, who have pushed back against this, who have said that this is not a good way to go ahead with the military? Or does that perhaps reflect that they're following the study and that the study is having some impact on the way military leaders see the issue of transgender people serving?
I don't know that I've actually seen or read some of the pushback from military leaders saying it's a concern or a problem for them.
There's been some pushback against President Trump's tweet is what I'm getting at, that they are saying that they're not sure that's the President Trump's idea is the way to go forward.
Oh, yes, yes. Right. Okay, I see what you mean. Sorry, I misunderstood. Yeah, I've seen that there's a lot of support and that for this past year with transgender people being in the military, it seems like it's been going okay, and I am very encouraged by that. I'm not really envious of it because of, you know, the timing of my own life, but I'm happy for those young men and women who are serving in the military, who have that support. The support of your commanding officer, the support of your fellow service members, it's one of the most validating things, you know, that you can have. Because life in the military, it's unique unto itself. And there really is a lot. It's next to a family. It's probably the most important relationships you can form sometimes with people.
You say you're not envious because you don't, at this stage in life, you're not thinking about going back and serving.
Oh, absolutely
anymore.
Not. But, you know, it's that whole hindsight. You're like, man, why couldn't it have been more okay when my time was in there? But I'm happy for things that the way that they're going now.
There will always be an argument, and it came about when they discussed allowing openly gay people to serve in the military. It goes back to when they desegregated the troops racially. There's the question of unit cohesion. You know, the military is there, you will hear people say, to kill people and break things. It's not a social experiment. When you were serving in the Air Force or in the Air National Guard, What do you think the reaction would have been? And I realize that there's, you know, lots of people there, so there's no one reaction. But, mm-hmm. you know, how would it have been acknowledged if you had said, well, I think I'm going to transition. I think I'm going to start hormone therapy, or I think I want to have surgery. Would that have been something that would have caused trouble amongst the troops?
When I think about the people, both active duty and through the Air National Guard, that I served with personally, and the different personalities, the fellow service members, coworkers, and friends that I made, if I imagine it, I think that I would have been supported by those people. I think that part of what I had to struggle through from having to be closeted in that part of my identity was my own concerns about the intimate living arrangements and feeling like I was having to compensate for this secret that I sort of had out of respect for especially fellow female service members. But a big part of what happens, or at least happened for me, being a transgender person who lived out a good, well, the majority of my adult life, not pursuing transition, not being at a point in my life where I felt like I could or absolutely needed to, you just sort of adapt. It may eventually lead to trouble down the road. And for me, obviously, it did, because it's a type of suppression. You're suppressing a part of who you are. But I do believe that, you know, had it have been permissible and there that this was happening, you know, what is happening now had happened back then, I think of those personalities and those great different characters that I served with, and some of the wonderful supervisors I had and commanding officers. And I think that, in addition to my personality, it would have gone well.
When you look back on your service, do you think in any way your struggles, if that's the right term that you were going through at that time before transitioning gender-wise, do you think any of that limited your effectiveness? Or did you do everything as well as you would have done after you had transitioned?
Yeah. That's an interesting question, and something I had never really thought about before. I certainly had no issues when I was active duty. I think maybe, though, some years later when I was serving with the Air National Guard, I was starting to personally sometimes have tinges of the depression. But it never affected or impacted my ability to perform my job. And yeah, I mean, I was a great airman and rose through the ranks to the level of technical sergeant. And I did a good job. And again, sort of reserved that part of my identity for my off-duty time or my private life, or, you know, however we, you know, arrange things so that they don't interfere and we conduct our jobs. If I compare that to what it would have been like to have transitioned and served, to be serving right now as Dirk, I probably just would have enjoyed life, would have felt a little brighter, just really not having to have anything in that basement, like I mentioned earlier. But performance-wise, I would have given it 110% either way.
Dirk, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Dirk Hamilton served in the Air Force and also in the Air National Guard. Since then, he has transitioned to a man. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The first votes in the state's 2018 election won't be cast until a year from now in the August primary. The general election is still 15 months away, but we do have some idea about the money which is being raised for candidates running for governor, the political party's state legislative committees, and by groups hoping to put ballot proposals before voters. Craig Mauger is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He joins us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. Thanks for being with us, Craig.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Governor. $7 million raised by candidates who are running or are expected to run, potential candidates for governor. How would that compare with recent election cycles, with 2014 or maybe more precisely 2010, which was the last time it was an open race for governor and no incumbent could run for reelection?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, Mark Schauer in 2014 was the Democratic candidate for governor, and he had pretty much had the primary path cleared for him, and he was raising money essentially to run against Governor Snyder in the general election. At the end of the off year, which was 2013, he had raised just over $1 million in the off year. So that was one candidate having pretty much the fundraising field to himself. And what we've seen already this cycle in 2017 preparing for next year is we've seen a handful of candidates, you know, raise about $1 million or have $1 million in their bank accounts. So really there's quite a few candidates that are upping the fundraising of what happened in 2014. And when you compare it to 2010, the last time we had an open seat in the governor's office. You know, there were primaries on both sides. You had candidates fundraising in the off year. And by the end of the 2010 primaries, the candidates had combined to raise, I think it was about $16 million in their own funds, not including the public funds they got later. And if you look at where we're at today, $7.5 million already raised by these candidates, it's about half already of what all the primary candidates collected in 2010. So that's a really quick pace that we're off to in fundraising for this position.
In 2010, of course, Governor Rick Snyder funded a lot of his campaign out of his own pocket, out of his own bank account. If we compare that to now, how many of these candidates are writing large checks to their own campaign?
Yeah, definitely. So Governor Snyder's 2010 primary race, he was the lesser known candidate at the beginning, and then he used his wealth to help inform voters across the state about who he was and tell his story. He put about $4 million into his primary campaign from his own pocket. So today, where it stands in the 2018 race, there's a businessman, another businessman from Ann Arbor, this time on the Democratic side, Sri Thanadar, who's already put over $3 million of his own money into his campaign. It's not clear yet how he plans to spend all of those funds, but when it comes to self-funding, $3 million is a very large amount to put into a primary campaign, and it raises the stakes for all of the other candidates who are trying to raise money from outside sources to compete.
So your list of fundraising totals here includes two gentlemen who are expected to run for governor but have not announced formally that they are in the race, and that is Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly and Attorney General Bill Schuette. Now, of course, they both have a lot of money, but this comes from previous campaigns, doesn't it? In other words, Schuette's runs for Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor's previous legislative as well as other money. In other words, this is money that was not specifically raised for governor. Is it easy then to transfer it to a race for governor?
Yeah, so for people who already hold public office and already have fundraising accounts set up for the office they currently hold, it's much easier to just continue raising money into those accounts. For someone like Gretchen Whitmer, who left the Senate years ago and closed down her Senate fundraising account, she had to set up a new fundraising account. And her only option, if she wanted to spend it on her own campaign, was to form a candidate committee for governor. So for Bill Schuette and Brian Kelly, they have an account set up for Attorney General and Lieutenant Governor, which they had set up in their last election in 2014, that's still there. And they've been raising money ever since the last election. So after 2014, when they were both reelected, they could not run again for those offices. They've been able to continue to raise money into those accounts since then, knowing they can't run for those positions again, not having to form a candidate committee for governor yet. So they've been sitting there raising money in these accounts. And what will happen if they get in is they can just transfer this money over into their gubernatorial account when they make the decision, if they make the decision. And Bill Schuette has about $1.5 million sitting in his account. I think Kelly has about $1 million sitting in his account.
So the state legislative committees, these are the committees for the Republicans and the Democrats, which are going to funnel money to state legislative campaigns, and the state House and Senate are both up for election this year. We had a very expensive race for state house in 2016. Do these preliminary numbers seem to indicate that, if anything, we can expect more money to be spent on the state house and probably see state senate spending, which outpaces the last election in 2014?
Yeah, definitely. So this is kind of the way that we put a kind of a test on how much money could be flowing in by the end into races for the state legislature. You have these four committees. Each caucus has a main fundraising committee: the House Republicans, the House Democrats, the Senate Democrats, and the Senate Republicans. So these tend to be the biggest spenders in elections for the state House and the state Senate. So what we've seen is that these caucus committees have been raising more this year than they have in any year in recent memory by this point in the election. Specifically, raising a large sum of money have been the House Republicans, which raised money to the House Republican Campaign Committee. They've been setting records this year with the amount of money they've raised. They've raised $1.19 million so far this year, above where they've been at this point in previous cycles. So this is kind of a test for what will happen later, because with all of this money being stockpiled by these four committees, what will happen with it? Well, what's going to happen is it's going to show up in the form of TV advertisements, maybe mailers, campaign staff in competitive districts. Most of this money will pour into, you know, about a dozen or so really competitive races next fall.
And those competitive races, as you and I have discussed before, it's usually not very many of them. But if we look here in Southwest Michigan, there's a state Senate district. Margaret O'Brien will be running for re-election for a seat that she won very narrowly in 2014. And if we look over at Battle Creek, there's a state House district which has been very close for two election cycles. And the incumbent, John Bison, has now said that he's going to run for state Senate. Should people who live in those areas expect to see a lot of ads on their television sets beginning sometime next year, largely fueled by these contributions?
I mean, they should expect to see it just about every cycle, because they live in a handful of the most competitive districts in this state. I mean, with the way the districts are currently set up, there aren't a lot of extremely competitive seats that are 50-50. You know, 50% of the voters tend to vote Democrat, 50% tend to vote Republican. And these districts that you're describing are two of them. And every cycle, basically, there are going to be races year in and year out there. And in every cycle, they're going to be extremely expensive. And the advertisements on TV screens in the district are going to be showing very negative campaign ads, most likely.
We don't know which proposals, if any, yet are going to make it onto the ballot next year. But we do know that there has been a good sum of money raised so far for especially three of them. So describe these campaigns where so far more than $800,000 has been raised in an effort to sway voters, or at least get an issue on the ballot and then sway voters that this should be approved.
Yeah, so right now across the state, really the campaigns of ballot proposals, these are proposals that want to try to get a law changed or the Constitution changed by avoiding the normal legislative process. And to do that, it requires gathering hundreds of thousands of petition signatures to avoid the normal legislative process. They're right now laying the groundwork and in some cases advancing forward with their campaigns, gathering signatures to try to achieve that. We've been tracking about five ballot campaigns in terms of their fundraising. We have now added a sixth that has started raising some money, and that's a campaign to bring a requirement that businesses offered earned sick leave for their employees. So we're looking at those six. Of the six, three have been really far ahead of the other three in terms of fundraising. One is the proposal to establish a part-time legislature. One is a proposal that aims to repeal the state's prevailing wage. And the other proposal is a proposal to legalize marijuana in the state. Those three campaigns have each raised more than $800,000 so far in 2017, and they all have been pretty active in what they're doing out there.
One of the things you note in your report is that the group Voters Not Politicians, which would change the process for drawing the boundaries for congressional and state legislative districts, has more direct contributions than the other campaigns. Is that potentially significant?
Well, they've reported the broadest donor base of the six campaigns so far. I mean, I think they have about 2,000 individual contributions that they've received so far, which is a large number. The contributions are just smaller. I mean, they're receiving a lot of $25, $10, $100 contributions. And when you talk about other campaigns who are receiving contributions of over $100,000, individual contributions reaching that level, it takes a lot of $100 contributions to reach $100,000. And that's what's happening with the redistricting campaign. I mean, they've raised, I think, over $100,000. You know, running a ballot campaign is expensive, and I think they would tell you that they need to raise much more money, and they're out there trying to raise money to fund their effort.
And one of the reasons it's very expensive to run a ballot campaign is that normally you have to pay people to collect petition signatures to get on the ballot. So since we do have three well-funded campaigns to this point, is that an indication that voters are more likely to vote on a ballot proposal after 2016 when nothing was on the ballot and 2014 when there were two ballot proposals both related to wolf hunting?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is maybe at this point it's a little bit more likely than those years what we saw happen there. But keep in mind, I mean, these groups have to gather hundreds of thousands of valid signatures. It's a very difficult process. They have to do it within 180 days. The state has this strict 180-day window to gather all of these signatures. It's a very costly venture. And right now, I think the marijuana campaign that's raising, you know, more than $800,000 and is out there working pretty hard from what it seems to the public, at least, they seem to be one that could achieve this because of how successful they've been in fundraising. They have experience from the last campaign. They have a national group kind of helping them. And it's possible with them right now. And then this prevailing wage repeal campaign, they're trying to get the proposal to the legislature. So what could happen with their proposal is they could get the number of signatures required, and then it could be sent to the legislature who could approve it. And because of the way this is done, the governor, who has some hesitations about this proposal, doesn't have to sign it. So as long as they get the signatures and the legislature approves it, which is expected, they won't have to go to the ballot in 2018. So it's a bit of a mystery there if that will actually happen or not. And then with the Clean Michigan part-time legislature campaign, it's a mystery there still. I mean, they've had some problems with their language getting off the ground. So it remains to be seen what will happen. And over the next 180 days, 6 months, a lot will come out about how serious some of these campaigns are.
Overall, Craig, would these reports indicate that, if anything, there's going to be a dramatic uptick in spending on campaigns in 2018 compared to maybe a like cycle, the 2014 campaign, where it was a non-presidential year, but governor, state house and Senate and, you know, attorney general and secretary of state were on the ballot?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's an easy question, because what is the trend in politics right now? Every election cycle is getting more expensive than the previous election cycle. That's the path that we're on. That's the path that we have been set on because of the boom in independent spending. We have these outside groups that can come in, raise unlimited amounts of money, and spend unlimited amounts of money in our elections. And cycle after cycle, these groups are spending more and more money. So it's easy to say at this point that the expectation is that the cost will continue to go up. And we already have some very real indicators pointing to that. You know, number one being these caucus committees are raising more money right now. Number two being the fundraising that we're seeing happening from candidates for governor right now. They're already raising more than seemed to be raised in the last two cycles. And then because of the increase in independent spending, the governor's race could be more expensive very easily if it continues to be close, as many expect it will be through the fall of next year. 2018 will likely be very different than what we've seen before, and could very easily reach up into the ranks of the most expensive governor's races that we've had.
Craig Mauger is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He joined us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The Michigan Campaign Finance Network's reports on the money raised so far for the 2018 election can be found at mcfn.org. You can also find links at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.